Yes, and you're in tune to the search engine Pisa FM 90.1 with Anthony. And I'll go straight over and say hello to Andrew. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Anthony. How are you doing?
I'm good. And thank you for agreeing to come on my show. Andrew, give us just a little bit about you and how you came about to have this interest in this phenomenon.
Yeah, well, thanks for inviting me onto your programme. And I think we're probably going to say some quite unusual things, cover some quite unusual areas tonight that people might find a bit difficult to deal with. So I do urge them to check what I'm saying, you know, which is going to be true.
And what I want to just say to you also, and I did say before, is to also, you know, you're going to have to forgive my level of possible questioning to you in clarifying some of the points that you might talk about. Because, like I say, it's an area that I'm only surface level on.
Right. And I think, you know, that's the case for a lot of people. Just to give you a bit of my background is actually in what's called software engineering, which is basically computer programming. I did that for a period of about 20 years, designing systems for small-scale systems, things like telecommunications software, process control software, which, you know, controls machinery and factories and this sort of thing. And I also sort of developed an interest in teaching and education, and was a full-time lecturer at a college of further education in Mansfield for a couple of years. And now I've ended up working part-time for the Open University, and I have two teenage children, and over the years that they've grown up, I've been mainly working at home, doing student reports and disabled student assessments for the Open University. I've also been doing a little bit of software development work a few years ago as well, so I carried on that line of activity. So my background is basically a technical one. I try and look at information, you know, break it down, work out what the problems are, work out the inconsistencies, and then try and move forward from there. You know, and that's what engineering basically is. An engineering discipline is problem solving, you know, looking at why things don't work, designing solutions, and trying to move forward with those, and optimizing things and this sort of thing. So that's my sort of mindset, really. I've always been interested in what I like to call alternative knowledge. I think that this term conspiracy theory, I try to avoid using that, because that is basically a way of marginalising one's thinking. It's a bit like, you know, when you're at school calling somebody, you know, a wimp or something like that, or just being, you know, putting them down in some way. And they, therefore, you know, I think you end up on the wrong starting point with that phrase. So I try and avoid using that as much as possible, but it's inevitable that it is going to come up. And I saw an object in the sky way in the distance when I was 9 years old, actually two objects doing acrobatics around one another. I mean, I knew it couldn't be a star, I knew it wasn't a comet or a planet or anything like that, or an aircraft, because I had a reasonably good knowledge of what was in the night sky at the age of 10 years old, having read a few books and things. And my friend saw it as well, a girl that I was at school, she saw these two little objects as well. So I've always had an interest in things that we're not really told much about. And, you know, so I've tried to follow some of the stories that have come up. You know, you mentioned there in the introduction the Roswell incident. I found out quite a lot about that. That's a big one. There's also the Rendlesham Forest incident, which happened in Suffolk in 1980. There's a lot of information about that that's now become available in the last 15 years or so. And then it was really, I was watching a documentary about that incident, which I didn't really expect to find out a lot more about. Back in 2003, there was quite a good BBC documentary which revealed a few things which I'd never heard before. So I went onto the internet, and I'd just got broadband internet back in 2003, so you could, you know, you could stay on all the time. You didn't have to dial up. And I found this, as you also mentioned, this thing called the Disclosure Project. And we'll come on to 9/11 in a minute, but that was my starting point, finding out that there was actually an awful lot of information available, and this information was coming from people who were in the military, people who were in the Federal Aviation Authority, which is like, you know, air traffic control, people who worked in the army, you know, certain people who were in the presidential administrations. I started to explore this between about 2003 and 2000, and say probably 2005, 2006, and I really became absolutely convinced that there is a cover-up, and the cover-up of the UFO issue is not really to do with aliens and extraterrestrial life. You know, you'll see fair number of TV programs where people will say, yes, you know, there's life on other planets, and, you know, we've talked about finding bacteria on Mars, you know, and finding bacteria that's come here on comets and this sort of thing. So that's a fairly safe area. But what the Disclosure Project illustrated to me in 2003 was the really one of the key issues as to why there isn't serious discussion of this topic is energy. It's to do with energy. And that is why the subject, that is one of the primary reasons why the subject is marginalised. The alien ET life thing is kind of secondary to that, I would say. And this was something that was brought out in Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project, essentially because what some of his witnesses were saying is that, you know, alien craft have been here, they've landed, they've been shot down. Some people had given accounts of these craft being brought down using high-powered radar in the 1940s, and therefore, you know, these craft came to the ground. What happened to them? Well, they didn't end up in the museum, we know that much. They ended up in the hands of, guess what? They ended up in the hands of the military, which means the US Air Force. And, you know, for example, it's not difficult to find out that in 1947, President Truman signed the National Security Act, which brought into existence the National Security Council, which was just after the end of the Second World War. And of course, they used that.
So why, Andrew? Then did you? Why did you get so? Because you, I've seen your videos. I've heard you speak.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is it held on to you and made you so passionate about this topic?
Well, the reason is, the basic reason is that most of what we are given in the mainstream media is a fraud. For example, we don't need petrol-based technology, you know, kerosene-based engines. We don't need any of that, right? You can look at the research, for example, of Nick Cook in the book The Hunt for Zero Point, and other books as well. And he points out that in the 1950s, all of the major aircraft corporations, aerospace corporations at that time, were doing research into anti-gravity technology, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then in about 1956, it all was all shut off somehow, and it appeared to go underground. And he would contend, and I would agree, that it went into the black world. It went into the super secret world, which you and I don't get to hear very much about, right? So that means that we have technology, we don't have it, somebody has it, somebody on the earth has it, which is far in advance of anything that, you know, you or I see in the sky or on the road. We don't need roads, we don't need petrol, right? And you listen to some of what Stephen Greer's witnesses said. They talk about technology being developed where, you know, you don't really need hardly any fuel, if any fuel at all. You can get propulsion technology which operates on vacuum energy, on zero-point energy. So that's the whole of the oil industry out of the window.
So is it like when you know all this and you see out there that people are struggling to live, having to pay for these fuels that are being put out there and prices put down and up by these banks and corporations?
Right.
It's just that I've got a text that's coming in here, which kind of like is in the same line of what I just asked you, and I'm going to put this to you and ask you. It says 3-2-1, it says, why are we discussing the topic? What is the benefit to mankind? And they've ended saying, this is a serious question, and that's from the...
Sure, no, that's a good question. The benefit to mankind is that we don't have to do any environmental damage. We can travel to the stars. We can have as much energy as we need, which means that we can desalinate water to irrigate deserts. We can solve all of the problems of scarcity in the world. I've come to understand that all of the problems of scarcity are artificially created, right? But that's a whole other issue. And this is down to how much energy we can produce, right? Now, of course, people say to me, and you can go and hear some of the talks that I've done on YouTube and so forth, well, let's take the energy issue just, you know, and we'll try and get onto 9/11 from this as well, but let's take the free energy issue. Okay, so I've invented this device, right, and it's an engine, and it doesn't use any fuel, right? So everyone's going to want that. Everyone's going to want that, you know, magnetic, the engine runs on a spinning magnet or something and doesn't use any electricity and doesn't use any petrol. Everyone's going to want one of those, right? So if I take that to some company, they're going to want to produce that because they're going to sell them in absolute, you know, bucket loads, right? So that means that I'd be a multimillionaire overnight because I'd have this engine. Now, if you actually go and do the research and find out about these various devices like this that have been created in the last 100 years, basically, there are a number of examples. None of them come into production. So you're then faced with, you know, a choice in your mind. Well, that either means that all of these people that have produced these devices are all idiots, they're all confidence tricksters, or they're all scammers, or all of these devices, without exception, have been taken out of production, the inventors have been killed, and their laboratories have been burned down, and their equipment confiscated, or alternatively, when you get to a business deal to produce one of these devices, it's been wrapped up in financial problems or legal wrangles and this sort of thing. And what you'll actually find is, it's the latter which is true, not the former, right? If you do the research. Now, I'm just saying this, so to anybody listening, I could be just making this up. So you're only going to be able to convince yourself whether I'm, you know, actually telling the truth on this or whether I'm just kind of making it up to sound credible. You're only going to have to do your own research and find that out for yourself if what I'm telling you is true for that part of it.
Okay, well, I hope that answers your question. 3-2-1, and I think it's very difficult to say what type of topics shouldn't be discussed on radio, or obviously if it's offensive in some way or causing somebody pain and hurt, then you've got to think about that. But as much as possible in a way like when you have to change your conversation but still have a serious topic with a child, but change the way you talk to that child. But there's serious topics that you have to sometimes have with a child, you know, and I think there's topics that we have to have. And some people may think, no, that topic, why are we discussing that topic, like you texting there 3-2-1? And my view is, there's always, it may not be for you right now, but there may be somebody else who it is for. But the fact that you asked the question in the way that you asked the question, I appreciate.
Yes. I'd just like to add just a little bit to what I said there about the energy issue. And the devices, you can go and research, anyone who's listening and wants to make a note of this, you can go and research the Lutec device, you can go and research the N machine, which was Bruce De Palma, you can go and do research into cold fusion, you can go and do research into Faraday's homopolar generator, you can go and do research into Adam Trombley's closed path homopolar generator. You can look at all of those technologies on the internet and you'll find the same story. I'm trying to just point out there that I'm not just making this up as I go along. You know, so that's just some notes for people to go and follow up if they wish.
Okay, Andrew, I've got a couple more texts and then I want to go on to the 9/11. Damien, this is from 447. So Damien Marley featuring Nas, Patience. This song does the same thing this topic does. Think. And that's from Jovan. God bless. Now, I there's two ways I'm looking to take that, Jovan. Does the same thing the topic does, think. Are you saying it makes you think? Because if that's what you're saying, then I agree. Because I think that's what it does. It does make you think. It makes you come out of this box and think differently. 559 says, the capitalist world will hide these things from us. Because if we knew the truth, we would rid the world of poverty, disease, war, etc. These things are the things that keep capitalism thriving. And that's from Mark. Thanks for that, Mark. Did you want to say something on that?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the capitalism model is essentially, when you get it down to the basics, based around scarcity. You know, that you have something that other people don't have, therefore you can sell it for money, you can trade it, you know. And of course, at a basic level of bartering, that's okay. But when you corporatize it and have these huge multinational companies, like, for example, take De Beers, you know, how they control the diamond market and they create the scarcity for diamonds, which is very common, actually. That's just one example. And the same is essentially been done with the energy and the oil market. You know, that's the truth as I now understand it.
Yeah, definitely. And so with 9/11, okay, we've got the stories out there. I think most people, like some of the people will say, do you remember where you were when Diana died and things like that? It was the same with 9/11. Mm. You know, I do remember where I was when it took place, although I was hearing it over the radio and not seeing the imagery. But the stories and the questions are there. And the one that has always kind of like stood out is the way that these buildings have felt. And the controversy about saying, you know, it had to be a controlled blast or something like that. Now, when I listened to your discussion, I hadn't heard what you had put forward as the theory for why these buildings and why they collapsed the way they did. Mm-hmm. Did you?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not a theory, at least not initially. And in fact, it's not really a theory at all. Because with 9/11, you just have to look at what actually happened, right? Now, fortunately, in our information age, you can go onto YouTube and you can replay the videos of the horrible thing that happened to the Twin Towers, okay? And, you know, you mentioned right there the towers fell. And I used to think they fell. I was told that they fell. And I've heard that expression, collapse, they fell. A debris pile, but if you go and look at the videos again, and I urge people to do this, you know, and I urge people to contact me if they can't find any information and want more, go on to checktheevidence.com, click on the contact button, and say, hey, Andrew, you know you're on about this. Can you send me a link? I'll gladly send people that information. But look at the videos of the towers basically coming apart. They did not collapse. If you look at, you know, one or two particular videos from particular angles, which are fairly close, you can see these steel beams, right, coming out of the main structure. They're coming downwards, but you can see a couple of them these steel beams are turning to dust as they are travelling through the air. How can this happen?
The steel beams are turning to dust.
Now, you might think, oh, well, that's just an effect of the video or something, or that's just the angle you're seeing it from, or it's an effect of the light. So is that statement true? Well, you then want to establish whether it's true or not, if you're interested in the truth, that is, and not a theory. So you go and look at some other evidence. Well, what would be some other evidence? What about if people were standing very close to where these steel beams were coming to the ground? If those steel beams were solid when they hit the ground, you would see them on the ground, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Agreed? If they were solid while they were falling, they would be solid when they got to the ground. So you would see them on the ground, right?
Mm.
But if you look at the size of the towers and look at the aftermath, the ground, the next day or on the same day, you will see that there's hardly any steel. There is some, but commensurate with these. These were the fourth tallest buildings in the world. There is hardly any debris left. About 85%, as a conservative estimate, of those buildings turned to dust. Right, I calculated that there's over 700 miles length of steel in those buildings in total. 700 miles length worth of steel sections, if you added them all in a long line. You look at the...
And did this happen to all the buildings?
It happened to towers 1 and 2. They turned to dust over a period of about an hour. The final process took about 8 and 10 seconds for the two towers. Building number 7, which people are less familiar with, although there's quite a lot have been stated about that now, that also came to the ground. Came to the ground. It didn't fall. It turned to dust, essentially, at about 20 past 5 in the evening on 9/11. The other four buildings, one, two, three, four, five and six, they were all destroyed as well. So all seven buildings were either destroyed outright on the day or were so badly damaged that they had to pull them down immediately afterwards.
And all these buildings were linked?
Kind of, yeah. They were all in the same small area. And the only buildings that were damaged badly on that day, well, apart from the Bankers Trust, which was across the street, had a WTC prefix. The other buildings, which are right next door, you know, just across the street, 50 yards across the street, apart from the Bankers Trust, were not damaged. Right? You can go and see that in all the photographic record. Did the buildings come to the ground? Well, if they came to the ground, right, they would have crashed. They would have made a crashing noise, or you would have felt them coming to the ground. A 1,000-foot building comes to the ground. Mm. Is it correct or not?
No,
yes or no? You don't need a theory about that. If a 1,000-foot building comes to the ground in chunks,
you should feel it.
You should feel it. The ground is going to shake. But if you look at the seismic signature from the charts, which were recorded from the Palisades recorders, I think that's the name of them, and this is all documented in Dr. Judy Wood's book, which I've helped to distribute in the UK. It's called Where Did the Towers Go? The ground did not shake for long enough. So that evidence also shows that the towers did not hit the ground in solid form, right? You also look at the construction of the towers and you find out that they were constructed in what's called the bathtub, because the lower levels of the towers, some people might know that there were actually there was a big shopping mall under where the towers were, the mall stores, they went 9 stories underground. That 9 stories was below the level of the Hudson River, which is the river which was next to Manhattan Island. So these buildings were constructed in what's called the bathtub, or a slurry wall, so that it had to be used to keep the river out, basically. And these two 1,300-foot-high buildings, say over 1,000 feet high, when these came to the ground, the bathtub wall was not damaged. And earth-moving equipment, which was moved in to get rid of the debris in the days afterwards, reports in the newspaper said that they were worried about the large buckets crashing into the bathtub wall, you know, and causing a breach and the flooding coming in. They weren't worried about that from the towers coming down for some odd reason. How is that possible? We're not talking about theories at all here. We're talking about observations and the way that things behave when they fall down versus what actually happened.
Can I text you that says the announcement regarding the third building was announced as destroyed by news reporters, even though it was still standing?
Correct. Yeah, that happened at around about 5 p.m. where CNN reported that building number 7 had come down, and it hadn't actually come down. It happened 20 minutes later, and then the BBC repeated that report. Yes. So there are some very, very well-established strange events like that. And when the BBC were queried about this, they couldn't answer this question. I had somebody from the BBC writing to me as well back in 2008, because a chap from the BBC who was producing the documentary about 9/11... he wrote to my friend, Dr. Judy Wood, and asked her to be interviewed in a quote-unquote quick chat. And I asked what he wanted to discuss in this interview, and he just said it was going to be a quick chat about the research. And I pointed out to him that the BBC had already produced a hit piece which essentially was covering up, in other words, the facts that I've just given you, and they are facts, they're not theories, and there are many more, they were not covered. Listeners have probably never heard what I'm telling them right now before, because that's not been discussed on the BBC, it's not been discussed on ITV or Channel 4, it's not been discussed in any of these places. It's not even been discussed in some of these alleged truth groups, such as Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which I have evidence in spades that they are no such group. They're not for 9/11 Truth, they're Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Cover-Up. Because they claim that the buildings had explosives planted in them, this thing called thermite. But the problem with that is, however the buildings were destroyed, whether it was with planes or fires or bombs, if that would involve cutting the steel sections into chunks, right? So whether it was the steel was cut up by a fire or plane crashes, or bombs, or terrorists, or whatever it was, those chunks would have fallen to the ground, right? And in falling to the ground, they would have caused the seismic signature, and you would have seen the chunks on the ground, right?
So is that down to their level of understanding within that area of engineering or architecture?
No.
So you're saying that they know how,
yes,
and the real reasons,
correct,
why these buildings fell in that way, and metal,
yeah,
was able to turn into dust, and they're choosing not to say it.
Correct. They are trying to persuade people that what I've just told you about the buildings coming down in dust is not true. Right, and I've written a whole book about that. It's called 9/11 Finding the Truth, and it's available for free in electronic formats from my website. Somebody has very kindly made it into an audio book. It's a bit of a slog, and really it's not what I would call a beginner's book, because they're going to have to do some groundwork as regards, you know, watching the videos that I've just told you about to check that what I'm telling you is true, and I'm not just, you know, blowing smoke or whatever expression you care to use. You need to establish that as a starting point for yourself. Did the buildings turn to dust before they hit the ground or not? Is Andrew Johnson making a correct observation here, or is he wrong? I would like people, I invite people to try and establish that for themselves. Because then when you've established whether that's what actually happened or not, you know, that's what you can move forward from. If you go to a crime scene and you see a dead body, you don't just immediately assume that it was your next door neighbour that shot the person because you don't like that person, you know. You do a forensic investigation, you know, what's happened to the body, you know, does it have a bullet hole in it, was it poisoned, was it somehow run over by a car, you know, you look at the damage to the body to establish how the person was killed. It's the same with 9/11. You don't just assume that terrorists did it because the BBC said that or ITV said that, when there's no evidence that this actually happened, but that story gets repeated for, you know, 13 years and more. You go back and look at the actual videos, and there are many, you know, there are hundreds in fact, and see what actually happened. And then you move forward from there. That's what you need to do if you want to understand this.
So then, okay, what makes steel turn to dust? What makes buildings disintegrate in such a way and leave a pile of rubble, like
right,
just a mound rather than a pile?
Yeah, that's the absolute question you must try and answer. And my friend, Dr. Judy Wood, she's essentially done that in her book, Where Did the Towers Go? And she's done it in some of the videos which are on YouTube and stuff, which you can watch. So what you do is, let's go back to the body analogy. Well, what happened to the body? Oh, look, it's got a bullet hole in it. That means that it was somebody must have had something like a gun that shot it, and then you maybe look for the bullet. Was the bullet, you know, lodged in the wall or something like that, or in a tree or in a piece of furniture or something like that? Then you'd be able to look at the bullet, so you can find out more about the weapon. Right now, in that instance, from the bullet, you might not be able to tell whether it was a rifle, or you might not be able to tell whether it was a handgun or something else. So what do you do then? Well, you look at all the evidence from the World Trade Center site. You look at 40,000 pictures of before and after, right? And you can see, for example, things like upturned cars. Why would a car be upside down? What causes that? You look at, for example, a frontage where all the brickwork is intact, but all the glass has been blown out, or all the marble has been blown out, or the granite has been blown out. You look at other damage to cars in the vicinity. You look and you see that all the metal on the car looks as if it's been burned, and you know, the paintwork's flaking off. But you look inside the car, and the upholstery is all intact. So you know, for example, that it couldn't have been a normal fire, because a normal fire would have burnt all the upholstery, as well as, you know, creating burning effects on the metal. You then start to listen to people's accounts of what actually happened. You hear accounts of them like Patricia Ondrovich. She's walking down the street away from the towers to get away, I think, from the dust cloud. And the cars on the street are exploding while she's walking past. Why are these cars exploding? What would cause that? You look at, for example, that when the towers were destroyed, we're told that they burned down or severely weakened by the fire and then collapsed. Yet, if there was a lot of fire, why is all the paper survived? Why is there all this paper blowing around the streets? So you're looking at here, I've already mentioned a couple of things there, that whatever destroyed the towers has different effects on different materials, right? So it doesn't affect things all the same way. For example, it seems to affect aluminium one way and it affects steel another way. You look at some of the cars and they've got intense rusting on them, which means that it looks like something's happened to the steel in the car, in the metal of the car. It's changed into iron. It's undergone some type of chemical or nuclear reaction. You then, for example, look at some other studies which found a high level of substance called tritium. A high level of a substance called tritium, which is like a form of hydrogen, which is only found when nuclear reactions have occurred.
Okay.
So what are nuclear reactions to do with? Well, what do we use a nuclear power station for? We use it to generate energy.
Energy.
So what we're looking at, and I've covered this very, very quickly, is energy. What destroyed the World Trade Center was a form of energy, all right? This is the conclusion that you can get towards if you study all the evidence. And that's why I started off talking about energy in relation to the UFO cover-up as well, because this is what they don't want people to know about, right? That's the key factor, because once you observe that the towers did indeed turn to dust, once you observe these craft coming here and landing, and they're not traveling, you know, they're not using petrol, they're not using kerosene, they're not using a nuclear reactor, not least the type that we use, they're using something else. Once you observe the towers didn't burn down, they weren't blown up with bombs, and they turned to dust before your very eyes, how was that done? It was done using energy, right? It was actually done using a directed energy weapon. And this is what the conclusion that Dr. Judy Wood came to. Now, she doesn't, you know, people say to us, well, that's just nonsense, it's just silly, because you can't say, you know, you can't say, for example, where this weapon was, you can't say who owned it, you can't say how much energy was used, it must have been an awful lot of energy to destroy those towers, mustn't it? No, you're making an assumption that this energy is used in the way that we've seen energy used, you know, in everything else. Like, for example, people say, oh, it's a laser beam, then, Andrew. You're saying it was a laser beam? No, I'm not saying it was a laser beam, and neither is Dr. Wood. Oh, it's a microwave beam? No, no, not a microwave beam, not in the conventional sense. This is the people jump to conclusions, and because of what they've seen, you know, science fiction films or science fiction stories, or they've seen a documentary, for example, they're now started to talk about using directed energy weapons in the military. This was done in 2003 with the mobile tactical high energy laser and the airborne laser. These are systems that are in the white world now. You can look them up and look at the websites for these projects.
But that's like the program, isn't it? That's the nurturance that we have, because you're talking there and you talk about energy. You mentioned beams and proton beams, and all of a sudden that's what I'm seeing.
Yeah.
I'm seeing Captain Kirk with his
exactly
his thing pressing his whatever it is,
exactly
these like circle beam things firing out of whatever. But it's like your brain is just trying to find an answer,
Right. So those ideas are already in our culture and in our consciousness.
Mm.
And when I talk about these things and start to lead people through the evidence, that's what they tend to connect with, because it's the only thing that they can think of, you know, that's actually would connect with what I'm saying. But what we're talking about is something which is not like that. It's not like a laser beam, and it's not a form of energy which creates a lot of heat either, at least not in the way that it was used on 9/11. Going back to the evidence again, if you look, watch those videos, another thing you'll see when these towers come down, you see people, what are people covered in? They're covered in the dust, and they're coughing, they're spluttering, they're drinking water. Is their hair burned off? Are their clothes burned? No, they're not. Universally, you can see that almost no one suffered as a result of heat damage. So this form of energy, whatever it was, didn't create a lot of heat. Not like, for example, a nuclear bomb going off does, which generates a very, very large amount of heat. That's how it's designed to work. So this is a different type of energy. It's a bit like, again, looking at the body. You don't know what type of, you know it's a bullet of some kind, but you don't know what type of gun it is. But what we can say, and I'm going to sort of jump kind of a couple of steps here, is that I mentioned something called tritium, which you can find. There was a study, an official study of this in the water of the World Trade Center. And tritium is something that was talked about in the late 1980s and the late 1990s, okay? And it's actually, as I say, a form of hydrogen, which is a fingerprint. It's an indicator of radioactivity or nuclear reactions, as I said earlier on. And in the 1980s, some listeners may be familiar with it. It was a furore in science because of something called cold fusion that was discovered. And it was discovered by two chemists called Pons and Fleischmann. And they said that in their laboratory, they developed a kind of chemical reaction, which wasn't a chemical reaction, it was kind of a nuclear reaction. And they were getting lots and lots of energy out of their experiment, which shouldn't have been there. And this, they didn't call it cold fusion. This was actually, this term was given to the phenomenon by a Brigham Young University physicist and his colleague, the Brigham Young University physicist from Utah, was called Stephen E. Jones. And Paul Palmer was his colleague. And they named this process cold fusion. And a number of people reproduced these experiments, which were basically to do with energy, to do with creating relatively large amounts of energy from small amounts of reagents in this cold fusion reaction. And people say, oh, this was a hoax, it was a fraud. No, it wasn't. It wasn't a hoax and it wasn't a fraud. These experiments were reproduced, but the conditions under which this energy came out were poorly understood. You know, for example, you'd get two sets of experiments, same materials, same quantities, you know, same inputs. One would produce the tritium and the effects, and the other would produce nothing. So it was poorly understood. But then they later managed to get it a bit more reliable.
Mm.
Now, I specifically mentioned this physicist, Stephen E. Jones, and people can go and Google that name, because he came onto the scene of 9/11 research when I had already become interested, and we're going back, well, just about almost 10 years now to 2005, and he started talking about the World Trade Center having been destroyed not with an energy weapon. He started talking about the World Trade Center being destroyed using something called thermite, which is what's called an incendiary device. An incendiary. It's not a device. Thermite isn't a device. It's a compound. And thermite is just basically a powder. It's a bit like it's a bit like what goes into fireworks a little bit, and it burns at a very, very high temperature. And Stephen E. Jones wrote this scientific paper, which he sent me a copy of at the time, and he claimed that thermite was used to set the towers burning so that the steel would melt and it would cut through the steel sections and blah 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 blah. And I believed him, because, you know, my background is in software engineering. I did a degree in degree in computing and physics, but I didn't have the level of expertise in physics that he did. But isn't it just a coincidence that this very same physicist who named this process cold fusion, which one of the telltale signs of this fusion reaction was tritium, would become involved in 2005 in 9/11 research? Isn't that a bit of a coincidence? For me, when I found this out in 2007, because in 2005 I'd never heard of the guy, I didn't realise he was involved in energy research. And he worked for the US Department of Energy, you know, he was given a grant by them. Stephen E. Jones also worked at Los Alamos National Laboratories, which is where they developed the atomic bomb in the 40s. So he was basically hooked up with the black world, because the black world is where, you know, it's got a lot to answer for, basically. A lot of the things which should have come out of the black world haven't. And in fact, not only have they stayed in the black world, they've turned them into a weapon. So if people also want to know why we haven't got free energy, it's not only because of the economic interests that I mentioned earlier about the oil companies and so on. It's to do with military interests as well. That the weapons technology, the energy technology has been weaponized, and we now know and can prove that this technology was used to destroy the World Trade Center.
Okay, I'm going to have to take a break, Andrew, and we'll be back. But just before we go, I just want to read out a few of these texts that have come in. One says, "Oh my, this guy is on the money." And another one says, "CCTV images from a nearby fuel station of the Pentagon were very quickly demanded by agents and have never been released or shown. Instead, we have a very blurred video of a missile. The answer to the question Anthony asked is we have the technology to use energy to destroy solid material. This can also bring about intense heat." Got another question what says, "What does an energy weapon, directed energy weapon, look like?" And that's from 258 and 559. "The absence of evidence isn't the evidence of absence." So we'll answer especially that one about the weapon when we get right back. So we'll be right back a couple of minutes. See you in a little while. Welcome back. You are in tune to the search engine with Anthony on Peace FM 90.1. At the moment, I'm talking to Andrew Johnson, and we're just out there. We're having a conversation, and we're talking about 9/11, we're talking about extraterrestrials, talking about UFOs, and as always, your views, opinions are wanted, needed, and appreciated. 0759-964-2626. Any questions for Andrew? As you've heard, if you've been listening, he's been giving out loads of links to where you can look up more information on this area. And, I'm sure and I hope you've also found out why, in some reasons, this is a topic to be shared, in the sense that there are people fighting out there for energy and gas, electric, all these things. And there's enough out there for everybody, and it's being controlled very much by the few. Andrew.
Hi.
Hello. Hiya. Before we went, we had a text in that asked, what does a directed energy weapon look like?
Well, it depends what sort of weapon you're talking about. If you want to see some of the white world directed energy weapons which have come into service, there are two that I'm aware of, which I mentioned briefly in the first hour. There's the ABL, that's the airborne laser, which I think is I don't think they're using it in active service, but that's been tested. They've had successful airborne tests. It's developed by Boeing and Northrop Grumman. But that in itself is, I think, at least 10 years old now. There's the MTHEL, Mobile Tactical High Energy Laser, which is also developed by Northrop Grumman. There was also one that was tested on a US Navy ship, an energy weapon, and that the people could look into that if they want. And it basically, the one that, if you take the MTHEL, what it looks like is it looks like a big telescope, actually. If you see this thing close up in the videos, it's on YouTube, you can go and watch it. And this thing basically fires a very hot, high-powered laser at incoming missiles, and then it heats up the either the casing or the warhead of the missile net, and it explodes before it reaches this target. That's what the MTHEL is designed to do, and that's apparently been successfully tested in the field. It was apparently used in Iraq. So that, it basically looks like a big telescope. Now, I only mention that to try and answer the question as honestly as I can, because that really has nothing to do with what happened on 9/11 as far as we've been able to establish. The energy weapon that was used to destroy the World Trade Center, we have no idea what that looks like. The only thing that we can say about it, or a few things we can say about it, is its operating characteristics. In other words, the sort of way that it worked. We know that it used, for example, it seemed to rely on what's called a static field, a field of static electricity. And, well, I don't know whether we've got time to get onto that. Maybe that's another time. And it also seemed to have effects on gravity as well, but bizarrely, which I mentioned, the upturned cars. And it also employed some form of magnetism. And that's discussed in Dr. Wood's book because of the effects on the Earth's magnetic field, which were measured by magnetometers at the University of Alaska. So it appears to operate on some kind of interaction between the Earth's magnetic field and electrostatic field, which was actually appeared to have been present in a storm system which was near the World Trade Center on 9/11, which people don't know about, even though it's in the weather data if they want to go and look for it. And appeared to involve something like microwaves as well. Now, the reason I can say that with confidence is because of what's in Dr. Wood's book, some of which was submitted to court in a court case in 2007, which we won't get time to discuss. People can write to me about if they want more information about that. And we also found out of some experiments that were done by an experimental physicist in Canada called John Hutchison, who did these experiments in the 1980s, and he was experimenting with, guess what, microwave beams, electrostatics, magnetic fields, and even a radioactive source, and he was able to produce levitation. He was able to turn metals into jelly. He was able to change some parts of that metal into a kind of dust, and so he generated all of the effects that were documented in the evidence at the World Trade Center. This is Johnson. And so the energy that he was experimenting with was of different kinds, mixing them together, using different frequencies. And it's basically a process known as field interference. I realize that there are some technical terms there that I'm using, which, you know, I kind of, well, in some ways I make no apology for, because, you know, I'm trying to answer the question from my own knowledge of what we've so far discovered. There is a lot we don't know. As I say, we don't know where the weapon was. We don't know what the input energy was. We don't know who owns it. I think what I can say with some confidence is that we do know who knows who owns it, and that is a company called Science Applications International Corporation and Applied Research Associates. They are two companies that have knowledge of actually what happened to the towers. I would put money on that. I would bet money, good money on that.
What about the? I mean, this may not be something that you look at. You maybe just speak about why the towers collapsed or disintegrated the way they did. But why that particular weapon for that destruction?
Well, I assume that they were using it. They obviously had some ulterior purpose. They must have used this weapon instead of doing it another way, because it was the only weapon that was capable of doing the job, right? Because of the scale of those structures, you know, this wasn't just an overnight decision that they were going to do this. This was planned for, by many signs, it looks to have been planned for decades. That this was in the planning, you know. I mean, that's a whole separate area of study which I don't talk an awful lot about. But it looks like this was an event that was planned. And there is some evidence that a similar weapon was used on the Alfred P. Murrah building in the Oklahoma City, quote-unquote, bombing in 1995.
I was just going to actually mention that's what was in my head at the time, Oklahoma.
Right. I mean, we say that because if you look at the damage to the Alfred P. Murrah building, and there are pictures available on the internet, even though that happened few months before the internet was getting really popular. If you look at the Alfred P. Murrah building, there's a picture on Dr. Wood's website showing this, the internal damage on that, and compare that with the internal damage of World Trade Center building number 6, you will see it's very, very similar. And we also have similar damage to some of the cars which were near the building. Each of the buildings has similar damage to the cars. So it does look like this weapon wasn't the first usage. It was slightly different mode of operation, but it was used before.
And this weapon, like you said, the one that you're thinking of probably something that was created or known of about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is this production of these weapons that can produce these high levels of energy are being done by scientists?
We don't know who did it. I mean, the only clues that we have, I think some of the main clues that we have come from President Eisenhower's speech from 1961, which people some people may be familiar with. If you've got some listeners who have looked into the sorts of things I'm talking about, they may already be familiar. He made this speech when he left office. It's a very famous speech, actually. And he warned about the military-industrial complex and how it would become very, very powerful. And he also warned that we could become the victims of a scientific technological... or we could be hostages of a scientific technological elite. You know, and I think that's exactly what's happened. And Eisenhower could see the writing on the wall when he left office, and I think he tried to tell people that this is what was going to happen. So he was very worried that people in the shadows by 1961 had got a lot of power. And there were things that happened, like, remember the Gary Powers incident? Some people might remember that. I mean, it was before I was born. But this was the U-2 spy plane which was shot down over Russia. And Eisenhower didn't sanction that flight. Someone else gave the order, which, you know, on his behalf, for Powers to fly over the Soviet Union and thereby sort of heighten the tension in the Cold War. So I think it was at that point Eisenhower realized that he wasn't running the show. There were people in the shadows that were, you know, were doing things and influencing things. And I think we looked at those sorts of areas to find out why 9/11 was done and who did it. You know, I can't give anyone an answer to that question because I don't have enough evidence, frankly. You know, I can give pointers and things like that, but anyone who claims to know who did 9/11 is just blowing smoke. They don't have enough evidence, as I would understand it.
Okay. Just got a text and it says, the simple way to understand that there is technology out there that are top secret is to consider that when Captain Kirk was using a hand device to speak to Scotty thousands of miles away to beam him up, it turned up 30 years later as a Motorola StarTAC. Back then, there was no such thing as a mobile phone. That's from
right.
Max.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, with this knowledge and this information, we're saying it's here. It's on Earth, to a high level.
Yes.
Yeah. And but when we started this conference, we talked about learning from ETs in the sense of gravity, energy. So is this where, are they kind of like the prototype for what this weapon is that was used for this building?
I think, you know, if you use the Disclosure Project as a starting point, and you listen to what those witnesses said, I can recommend that people watch. There's a couple of videos which I think are really worth getting to perhaps three videos. One is a video called Billion Dollar Secret by Nick Cook. You can find copies on YouTube and stuff or other video sharing sites. And that was made in 1999. That's got some good stuff in it, where he goes to talk to some of these people about these so-called special access projects that are running Area 51. You can learn a bit about that. There is another good video from 2003 called Out of the Blue, which was made by James Fox, and that actually aired on the Sci-Fi Channel, I think it was in 2003. You will find out a bit about some of the technologies which were hidden in the 60s, and we talked, for example, we spoke tonight about the case of Robert Jacobs in the US Air Force, who's the optical instrumentation officer, and he filmed this craft firing a beam, a warhead in a nuclear weapons test. It's a dummy warhead in, I think, 1967 in Big Sur in California, or in that sort of area. And that's a very, very important piece of testimony from Robert Jacobs. You can clearly, you know, understand what he's saying. And the way that he describes it, he's got, you know, he can prove that he worked for the military. He's got pictures of him. He's got a letter from his superior, Sonny Mansman, who verifies that this actually did happen. That letter was obtained in 1996, I think, around that sort of time.
Yeah, because when I watched that, he was really animated about talking about it and quite angry at the fact that they'd cut the part where the UFO came in and shot those beams at that weapon, that it was taken out. And like you said, he's been talking about this since the 80s.
Right.
Now, the other thing that I said to you that struck me by what he said and what a couple of other people said on that video was about the fact that these ETs came to basically stop this weapon, if it was going to go out into the atmosphere or out into space, to destroy them. And this video also talked about the fact that there's been over 2,053 nuclear bombs that have been exploded on Earth, over 1,000 of them that have been done by the US. And this, in a way, kind of, I don't know if this is the right way to use it, have brought more attention to Earth by ET.
Right. Well, there's a few things we can sort of chew on there, because the first thing I think I'd add to that is that the whole issue of nuclear weapons became prominent after the Second World War. Because as we all know, the end of the Second World War was basically marked by the two bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Some people are now claiming on the internet that these were fake. There was no real bomb and stuff like that. It's a bizarre thing, I know, but that's what some people are claiming. I happen to think that that's not correct, and these things really did detonate. But you start to look, for example, at some of the modern theories of quantum mechanics and how when you go down into the atom and then you go down inside the nucleus and then you go down inside the neutron and the proton, there's basically nothing there and you end up at this sort of quantum foam level or something like that, you know. And when you start to think about these nuclear explosions and what's happening at that base level, and then you go into, the latest sort of quantum theory and string theory, it is said that there are other dimensions of space and time which kind of interact with our dimension to create, you know, our matter in our universe, okay? You
know, well, they talk about this dark matter, don't they?
Yeah, dark matter. Those sorts of theories that have come up in the last sort of 50 years. Now, there's a particular person that I've listened to called Wilbert Smith, and I've done a whole presentation on this guy, and he died in 1962. And there are other people that have said a couple of things similar. If you think of what's called the modern UFO era, right, as you were beginning to point out there in what you were saying, it seemed to ramp up right about the time when nuclear weapons and nuclear tests started to get going, around about 1947, because, of course, the Roswell crash happened in 1947, and there was a couple of others. There's a crash at Socorro. There was the Aztec crash as well. They were all in 47, I think. And there are a number of these crashes as well. If you go and do the research, as I say, you can find out about them. So it would appear that there were more craft coming here during that time. And Wilbert Smith argued that this was because these craft, they actually were travelling through, at least in part, through other dimensions. And when these nuclear bombs were going off, what was happening is, not only were they exploding in our, you know, world and causing all the devastation that we saw, they were also exploding in other dimensions, if you see what I mean, in these other almost quantum realms, which these beings actually, you know, I don't necessarily live in, but they realise that when that happens, it's really horrible for them. And so that's what drew them to, you know, to this, to our planet, basically. And that's why we started seeing more of them then. And, you know, it might sound like a crazy sort of fanciful idea, but just taking the basic evidence, you know, going back to what we again discussed for a few minutes before we came on air, you can look at the stories of Robert Salas, who was working on the Minuteman missile in North Dakota in 1967. He was in charge of Echo Flight, a flight of 20 missiles which were pointed at the Soviet Union, ready to go and blow them up. An object came and hovered over the base. He got a call from the topside guard, saying there was an orange object over the base. Salas didn't initially take the call seriously and told him to, you know, stop daydreaming or whatever he was doing. And then 5 minutes later, all the missiles started to go into a no-go condition and became unlaunchable. And he's got witnesses to back this story up who were also with him in the military. He's got documents. And in his own research, he found that this had happened, you know, sort of 10 times in a period of a year or something. I can't remember the exact figures. But he found, you know, in the 70s and 80s, after he retired, when he did his own research, that this exact same incident had happened at different installations across the US Air Force. And it's happened in the UK as well, in the Rendlesham Forest incident. It was revealed by Colonel Charles Holt, the deputy base commander, that he saw an object in 1980 flying in the forest, then it went over the base, and the object fired beams down into these hangars that they had there, where they were secretly storing nuclear weapons without the knowledge of the British government, or without the disclosed knowledge of the British government. And then these weapons also became unlaunchable, and they had to get a special team in from Germany to change, reset all the launch codes for these weapons. So again, if you do the research, check for the documents, you'll find that this has happened many times. So it does appear that there are groups, beings, whatever you want to call them, aliens, ETs, whatever you want to call them, that have their own interests in this, and they're watching what we are doing. And if you listen to, you know, there may be a few people that have seen lights in the sky, they've seen them hovering over fields or whatever. They're keeping an eye on us, you know, and who wouldn't, you know? We keep an eye on say, that, like animals when when they're sort of threatening some of our, say we've got a field of crops and some animals are threatening to impinge on it, you know.
Well, they've all got an eye on each other, haven't they? Because they've all got their weapons pointing at each other.
Right. So you know, they have their interests in this as well. And I used to think that all these, you know, stories about extraterrestrials, that they must all be, you know, technically advanced and therefore benign and everything. But now I'm not sure that's entirely true. You know, I think there are groups of beings. Some of them are quite similar to us. You know, they have the same faults and the same flaws. They're just more technologically advanced. Some of them are more highly spiritual than we are. You know, they're more caring, more benign, more loving. There seems to be, if you listen to all the witness accounts, people have encountered these beings, you know, and interacted with them. You know, and people will say, well, there's no evidence of these things. Oh, really? Well, you could have fooled me, because when I went looking, I found a lot of evidence. 5,000 cases of landings, for example, leaving traces on the ground. Ted Phillips did that research. A book of 74 UFO crashes by Ryan Wood. He's got documented evidence for that in ranking order. I've talked a lot about the so-called Star Child skull, which, again, I mentioned briefly to you before we came on air tonight.
Yeah.
I'll give you the story of that in a thumbnail sketch. This is physical evidence of an alien being, I would say, as things stand right now. This was a real bone skull. It was discovered in a cave in Mexico in 1930 by a 15-year-old girl who was exploring. She took the skull out of the cave against the instructions of her parents, of course, and shortening the story a bit, she took it home with her. There were two skulls she discovered together in the same cave, a human skull and a strange looking skull. She managed to save a bit of the tooth, the mandible of the alien skull, as it turned out to be, and it was kept in her family until she died, I think, in the 1990s. This girl, she died in the 1990s. It was passed to a friend of the family. The two skulls were passed. They didn't like having skulls in the house, so they passed it on to the current owners, Ray and Melanie Young, who live in El Paso, Texas. Notice I'm deliberately giving real names and real places here so that you can go and check this. They now are the owners of the skull. It was then passed to a good friend of mine who is sadly no longer with us, Lloyd Pye, in 1999. He was brought into the scheme of things because he had an experience in anomalous bipedal creatures, such as Bigfoot and its variants. And he looked at this skull and he thought it was so clearly not human, but, you know, humanoid, he would have an answer in 6 months. People would be all over it to investigate it. A piece of the bone was tested in 1999 in a Canadian police forensics laboratory, either American or Canadian. They declared that the DNA from the skull was human, and that was it in 1999. Once they got the result of that test, it was a human skull, forget about it, you know, took it away, bury it, whatever, forget about it. But the test, which is still the test, if you go on to Wikipedia and look up Star Child skull, that is the test they will list. They will say that the DNA was tested in 1999, found to be human, end of story. No, it wasn't the end of the story. Lloyd Pye was sufficiently unhappy with the DNA result, he knew it was wrong, that he had to wait another 4 years to do another test. And he had another test done, which was funded by Belinda McKenzie, a person I know who lives in London, and she paid about £16,000 for some further DNA tests on the skull, which was done by a company called Trace Genetics, and the report was produced. And they found that when they tested the nuclear DNA of the human skull, which was found with the Star Child skull right next to it in the cave, they got a normal reading of a human skull from, you know, DNA was of the expected of Mexican origin. In other words, it was a Mexican woman. But when they got the nuclear DNA of the Star Child skull, the thing there, they got no result. The primers, which were recovering the nuclear DNA, recovered nothing. Yet the skulls were the same age. When they dissolved the bone in the chemical that they used for extracting the DNA, didn't dissolve. Although when they tried to dissolve it, they put it in this solution, would not dissolve. The human bone dissolves straight away. What does that tell you? Well, it tells you the bone chemistry is all different. This is real physical evidence. All right? So it's all there. This is all there. It's all documented. The skull was then put under an X-ray. The skull had no sinuses. They could see this on the X-ray. It had no sinuses. This is, at the time, Lloyd thought this was unique. But there are a few humans that are born without sinuses. It's very rare, but it does happen. The skull's cranial capacity was, I think, 1600 cc's rather than 1200. It was 400 cc's bigger. The bone was thinner. It was stronger. In 2004, the bone was sliced through with a Dremel blade and put under binocular microscope. It had fibres in the bone. No other fibres have ever been found in any bone of any animal on Earth. And I'm just covering this.
Could they age?
Yes, it was carbon dated twice. They have had two separate carbon dated tests. 900 years old, plus or minus 40 years. That was the result that came out from two separate tests done in two separate laboratories. And then finally in 2010, another geneticist got involved. He was working with the latest DNA recovery techniques. And he was able to determine and recover a few more of the DNA sequences, base pairs sequences. And guess what? Having recovered several hundred base pairs, quite a few of them weren't found in any Earth species. So the National Institutes of Health in the USA has a database of 100 different types of organism, and it has all the DNA for those organisms sequenced. And, you know, for example, human DNA, we have some DNA sequences in our DNA which have, you know, the same as millipedes, for example, as well as monkeys. So 97% or whatever it is of our DNA is the same as DNA in chimpanzees. That's why they're called our closest living relatives, because we have the most number of DNA sequences that are in common out of all the other animals on Earth. You know, if you go to a dolphin, say, you might find that, you know, we've got like 90% the same DNA or something. The tests that have been done on the Star Child's DNA since 2010 basically are showing that this skull, which looks superficially human, it's got less than 50% of the DNA in common with human sequences. And not only that, but one of the key genetic sequences which was recovered is a special gene. And again, you can go and check this. You can go and check that I'm not just, you know, making this up. It's called the FOXP2 gene. Now, this is according to, if you're a geneticist, this is in the human body. The FOXP2 gene is a controlling gene, and it kind of dictates how certain other genes, you know, are generated or grown or whatever the correct expression is. And in the whole of the human species, there is only one genetic variation, or two genetic variations, that can exist in this FOXP2 gene, right? Because if you have any more than two, you would be dead, right? You can have one and it causes a loss of speech, you can't speak, and then two, any more than two, you're basically dead, right? If you compare the Star Child's FOXP2 gene, which was recorded by this geneticist, to the human one, I can't remember the exact figure, but there's about 55 differences. So let's summarise what I've told you. The bone chemistry is all different. The morphology is all different. The DNA is all different. You go onto Wikipedia or any other site, you will find none of what I've told you, right? They will just write up this article done by Stephen Novella in 1999. They won't tell you any of what I've told you, because they are part of the cover-up, as they are part of the cover-up with regard to 9/11. You know, Wikipedia, for example, I challenge people tonight, after listening to me, if they've got the time or interest, you go and start a page about Dr. Judy Wood, going back to 9/11, my friend who's written this book, Where Did the Towers Go? Just start a page about her, put a bit of her biography, just copy and paste it from her website, drjudywood.com, and put in a little bit about the book, you know, the contents page or something, or, you know, the summary of it or something. You will find that that page gets deleted within 48 hours. I can guarantee it. Same with the Star Child skull. You go and put some reference to this FOXP2 gene, which was discovered, I think, in 2012. You go and put a reference to that on the Wikipedia page for the Star Child skull. You will find within 48 hours that your additions have been changed and put back the way it was. because that's what happens. That's the way that this information is restricted, and why people like me don't have a voice outside programs like yours. That's just one example, and I could list many. You know, so basically what...
Got a couple of tests that have come here. Just going quickly to do that. The reason for 9/11 was to test the equipment and technology to change the law of the land, to allow the powers that be to erode our freedom of movement, expression, and freedom to challenge the government of the day. It has allowed them to flout the law. For example, the law insists that you cannot be detained without being charged. I give you Guantanamo Bay. Thank you for that. Another one, it says, Anthony, please, can I have a copy of the show? I had an emergency call out just before the show started. I've just got in and I am gutted. I've missed so much of the show. This information is very important to me. Thank you, Terry. Yes, definitely, Terry. Should be able to sort that. Now, we've had Andrew, the Star Child School. We've had, I don't know how authentic it is, but we see what they talk about Rockwell, and they've got a bean or something on a table where they're looking to put it open, and this regular image that you see sometimes, you know, even at Halloween, of this what extraterrestrials or so-called aliens are supposed to look like. And usually when we're seeing these things, they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now there is information out there that there are people who have had contact, presidents of America or our president, who supposedly has had meetings with ETs. What is it that you know about that? And what do you know about what type of conversation they may be having?
Yeah, well, that's a tricky one. We'll just mention that Alien Autopsy film, because that is pretty clearly the 1996 film, which was Ray Santilli. He came up with that in 96. And like you say, you see these stills from that. That is actually a hoax. It's pretty well agreed that is actually a hoax. Now, it appears that the reason why that was released is that the real Alien Autopsy film was somehow leaked. It was got either lost or leaked, or it was taken or fell into the wrong hands. And so they produced that film in case the real one was ever, you know, got into the public, because they just assumed that one was fake as well. It's a common disinformation tactic. You know, and I've got a contact who, that's the information that he gave me. So the Alien Autopsy film, you can forget that. That has pretty much now been determined to be a hoax. But it appears to have been based on a real film. And I'm pretty convinced myself, from the stuff that I've read, people that I've spoken to, that bodies were recovered from the Roswell crash, autopsies were done on them, and they were probably filmed, because, you know, movie cameras were available in 1947. So now we'll go to, what are these aliens like? You know, people have talked about interacting with them and so forth. Well, and particularly you mentioned the possible meetings with presidential people. That information is a bit more sketchy. What I'd recommend people look at, if they're interested in the presidential side of things, is a website run by my friend Grant Cameron. He runs a website called presidentialufo.com. Now, what he's actually done, his approach is very similar to mine, is you look at the evidence, right, as much as you can, gather as much as you can, and work out what's going on. So what he did was, he went to the presidential archives, right, and he did a document search. He asked the archivist to search for, say, for example, well, there's this story, for example, that Eisenhower had a meeting with extraterrestrials in, I can't remember the exact date, I think it was 1854. How do we find out if that's just somebody making that up, or, you know, if it's actually true? Well, how about you go and ask for copies of the president's diaries from the alleged dates, you know, of that meeting? And that's what Grant Cameron has done, right? So you can obtain copies of those sorts of documents. Where was the president on that day? Who did he have a meeting with, right? And I can't remember all the details of this, but this is your approach if you want to find out the truth, right? And I believe that the records show that he was a certain airbase on that day. He went to a certain airbase. I believe it was Holloman Air Base, right? Now, why was he at Holloman Air Base? Was he just going for a routine inspection, you know, just to see some new aircraft that had been sort of tested there or something? We don't know, because the meeting may not give you the reason, right? But if you look at what who he met with and what their responsibilities were, and if there was more than one person that he met with, and then look where they went the next day, you find that out, then you can begin to build up a picture of what those meetings may have been about or may not have been about. And I did read something more recently, of which I can't remember the details, but it does seem to suggest that something went on at Holloman Air Force Base in 1954, and President Eisenhower went there. There are also stories of the film, it's called the Holloman film, of a landing at Holloman Air Force Base around that time in 1954. And this film was offered to a chap called Robert Emmenegger, who was a producer for Walt Disney at the time, because Disney were approached by the government to make a film, you know, trying to acclimatise people to the reality of alien beings, you know, coming to the Earth and that sort of thing. And this was mooted in the 1960s, I think, or 70s. And as I say, a chap called Robert Emmenegger was approached and offered to be shown the Holloman film. They were going to give it to him, say, look, you know, we'll show you this film, and then you can talk about this in this documentary you're going to make for us. And then at the last minute, they said, no, you haven't got clearance, we can't show the film, and that was that, and it was never heard from again. So there are various stories that crop up like this from time to time, but it does appear that the government, the US government particularly, does have knowledge of meetings with extraterrestrial beings. You know, people really need to look into this very, very carefully. And there's also a lot of disinformation circulated. You know, for example, changing the dates of the meeting that Eisenhower, you know, was supposed to have been there, changing what he was there for, and this sort of thing. You know, some people, for example, say, we'll talk about President Kennedy. He got to know that aliens were, you know, meeting with, had met with Eisenhower, and he was going to tell the world about this, and he got this letter ready to break up the CIA and reveal the truth about aliens, and that was on his desk, and that was on his desk the day before he was shot. Now, that's the story I've heard. Is it true? I don't think that particular story is true myself. It's just a rumour. I haven't been seeing any credible documents that was the case with Kennedy. But certainly with Eisenhower, particularly the Eisenhower administration, there do seem to be quite a lot of documents which indicate that Eisenhower knew things and he was talking to people. And there is testimony from people like Brigadier Stephen Lufkin, who said that he was involved with meetings where Eisenhower was talking about, you know, flying saucers and aliens and keeping secrecy of these things going, you know. We have the stories of a group called MJ-12, Majestic 12, or Magic 12, and they had secret meetings. I came across a document last year, which was it's been around for quite a long time, which was given to me by a chap called Edgar Fouché, who I've interviewed for 6 hours. That's all on my website. And he, in his book, Alien Rapture, The Chosen, which is available on Amazon, he includes this document from the Majestic 12 group, which was alleged to be a group of 12 people in the military, the NSA, involving the US president and various other advisors, which, you know, they were in charge of keeping the UFO ET issue secret. That was their mandate. And they have a document which was shown to these members from 1947, and it was written by, oh crikey, I can't remember the guy's name, and it was basically a report on the alien autopsy. It was a report of the dissection of the alien's body. And you can read this report, it's in the book, I've got it on my website, and you've got to read through it and think about it. Has somebody made this up? Is it just a complete fake? But if you actually read it, to me, it looks like a genuine autopsy report to me. I can't see any problems with it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I got another text. It says, great guest. Although I've missed some of the show, your guest sounds familiar. Has he been on controversial TV with Ian Crane? And that's from Naomi.
I wasn't on with Ian Crane, no. I've been on Edge Media TV, which some people may have watched when that was on. That's folded now. And I've been on Richard D. Hall's programme. Richard D. Hall's website is another one you should check out. He's got many, many programmes covering a lot of the topics we're talking about here. RichPlanet.net. I highly recommend people have a trip to that website. And Richard's on every Monday night on Channel 192 on Freesat. He's got a programme there for the next 13 weeks. So if you want to find out more about what he's found out, then watch that programme.
Okay. Just more on this communicative level, Andrew. I mentioned to you briefly about C-SETI.
Yes.
Yeah. And part of the Sirius...
Sirius documentary, yeah.
Yeah, part of the Sirius documentary, there was a part where there's somewhere in America that what's the guy called? Who's
Dr. Steve Greer, yeah.
Right. He takes these people and he's having them sit down. It's like they're kind of like meditating.
Right.
But they've got this belief that they're actually, their thought waves or their thought intentions can be picked up and by these ETs, and they respond in some way. And in part of the video, you actually do see at one stage things come into the air and people become quite animated about it. But, and tell me if I'm wrong, but what I'm getting is that these people are saying that these beings are kind of like able to pick up on thought waves.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this again is a very tricky area because it's very unfamiliar to people and very kind of shaky territory because it's quite subjective. Now, I became familiar with the C-SETI program, which was launched by Greer in 2001, I think, which, as you say, what they basically do is, you know, I don't want to belittle the process because I think there is something in it. You know, I'm not sure it's quite what the people doing it think it is, but you go into a quiet location where it has a history of, you know, UFO sightings, and you sit quietly in a group, and you do a form of meditation. Greer calls it coherent thought sequencing. In other words, you kind of meditate using a particular protocol, if you will. And you then do kind of like what's called remote viewing, where you try and remote view another location, and you try and project your consciousness in a peaceful way, you know, into this location. And it is said by Greer, as you more or less said there, if there are extraterrestrials, they're functioning more on a telepathic level, and they can pick up on those thoughts and home in on you and, you know, fly their craft to meet you, basically, and you know, and materialise right in front of you. Now, it's not just Greer's C-SETI programme that claims to have done this. There is another group which has a very similar name. It's called E-SETI, which is James Gilliland's ranch, which I think, I can't remember where that is. And James Gilliland has done similar things, although James Gilliland doesn't have the connections to the military that Stephen Greer has. And, I don't know now what to make of this. Are these really, you know, enlightened extraterrestrials talking to these people telepathically? You know, I certainly wouldn't rule that out, but I think, without going into details, there could be something else going on which I'm not altogether comfortable with.
The reason why it kind of like resonates with me just a little bit is quite a while ago, I'd say even years ago, because like I said, I don't really focus totally on this topic, but the decision that I came across where there was this talk of dark matter and what dark matter is and where dark matter is and what dark matter responds to. And it was said that dark matter is all around us, it was saying that it can go through us, but then there was talk of it actually reacting to emotion. Don't know how true that is. And my thing was, well, if dark matter is all around us and is expansive within the universe and out of the universe, and that's what space is full of, then is it may be a crazy theory, but is something in the sense of the emotions travelling like on the wave?
Well, yeah, I think the basic answer to that is yes. I don't think there is any doubt that you can influence things with your thoughts, physical things. I mean, that's been sort of tested in a laboratory a number of times. You know, Andrea, one name that comes to mind is Andrea Pruharich, who did some experiments in the 70s. So there is no doubt that we have an element of ourselves which we can project beyond our physical bodies. I mean, when you, most people have experienced that in some form, you know, the most common one being, you know, you think of a friend and then that friend rings you, you know, the same evening or later in the day, or you receive an email from them. You know, and that's not, I don't think in all cases that's just coincidence. There is something else going on, right? And it does, there does appear to be some evidence that, you know, this has been suppressed. The people have tried to suppress this knowledge, you know, psychic abilities and psychic activities. And going back momentarily to one of the UFO questions, you know, we start talking about CSETI. Well, I'd like to tie back back into that, because you can find on my website and Grant Cameron's website, that's the Presidential UFO website, a memo which was written by Wilbert Smith, the Canadian radio engineer that I mentioned earlier on, although I didn't say he was a radio engineer. He became the superintendent of radio regulations in Canada. Now, by 1950, he'd essentially worked out that there was something very strange going on with the whole flying saucer issue, as he called it at the time. And he wrote this memo, which was classified top secret and was declassified, I think, in 1979. And in that memo, he talks about the secrecy surrounding the UFO subject, had been kept secret deliberately by the US government. 2 points higher than the H-bomb was the words that he used. He also mentioned that the Americans were doing research into the crashed discs and the technology that was used in them. And this technology, to use Wilbert Smith's phrase, involved mental phenomena. Mental phenomena. And the US was looking for help with that area of research. So what does that tell you? You know, and Stephen Greer, he talks about the ETs that he, you know, allegedly established contact with. They actually had technology which they could control their craft by, essentially by telepathy, by with their consciousness, not with physical, you know, pushing a lever and this sort of thing. So, you know, again, I certainly think that what Wilbert Smith said is true. I have no doubt that what he said was true. I've done a lot of research into Wilbert Smith. But where do you go with that? How do you go beyond that?
Well, Andrew, listen, we're going to have to do this again. Yeah, I've got a few more texts that are coming in. I'm running out of time. Just let me read these. One says, the governments of the world have spent many trillions of pounds and dollars over the last 75 years or more listening to experimenting on meeting with extraterrestrial beings. There have been projects, namely Canada's Blue Book project. Are you aware of that?
Well, the Blue Book, as I'm familiar with it, is an American project. But basically, yes, that was a research into sightings. Yeah, there have been studies, but most of them have been very much watered down. They've watered down the evidence very much.
Okay. Another one says, why would they spend all this money if there was no truth to this? And why do we have a Star War program based on how we deal with an extraterrestrial attack?
Well, I don't know if we've got that. We had something in the 1980s which was nicknamed the Star Wars program, which was the Strategic Defense Initiative, which was Reagan's initiative. But some people that I've spoken to, or certainly one person, would sort of say that there is some evidence, if you look very, very deep down and read between the lines, that there is a secret space command. And I do think, I've done a presentation about this, that there is a secret space program, you know, completely separate from all this nonsense with the International Space Station and all, you know, the space shuttle stuff and that. There is a completely separate space program. I mean, you know, so I think there may well be an advanced space fleet. I mean, this is what Gary McKinnon was, you know, said to have discovered evidence of in 2002, when he was doing hacking into these NASA computers and stuff. Mm. You know, so.
Yeah, brilliant, Andrew. Thank you very much for coming on the show. Anything that you want to just say that's happening right now that you feel, if anybody listening or have got a real interest, like Terry, you texting before, to get onto, to really get, in the sense of a core information or a good foundation to bounce off from, where would that be?
Well, I think...
Well, first we'll say your website, yeah, which is www.checktheevidence.com, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah, and I think that's
.co.uk.
You both will work, yeah, .co.uk and .com will both work. Yeah, there's plenty of material on there. You can just look at the homepage. I've got a whole list of videos right on the homepage there, which you know, you can watch. I think I've got the Billion Dollar Secret documentary link there and a couple of others. So you can watch through those if you want, you know, just sit back and watch some of those. There's some audio material. There's my free book, 9/11 Finding the Truth, which isn't really a beginner's book, but, you know, you could try it out, see where you get to with it. Dr. Judy Wood's videos, you know, if you want to find out about 9/11, richplanet.net, as I say, he's got a lot of stuff on there. Richard Hall has done a very good documentary about the Madeleine McCann case, and if you watch that, that will reveal to you in very stark detail exactly how the media covers things up, you know, because everyone has heard about the Madeleine McCann case, but no one has heard the truth of it, absolutely. You know, and if you watch that documentary, it's not about aliens, it's not about 9/11, you know, it's not about any of the sort of really kind of difficult to grasp stuff. It's about one particular case that you, unless you've been living on another planet, pardon the pun, or pardon, you know, direction, the deflection of the topic, you will have heard of Madeleine McCann case. And if you watch that documentary, I think it's a very, very good illustration of how people's psychology is manipulated, you know, and that's a good starting point, I think, to try and unravel, you know, why things are like they are now, you know.
That may be another show for us to actually have a look at. I feel quite interested in finding out how that goes.
Okay,
Andrew Johnson from checktheevidence.co.uk. Andrew, thank you very, very
thank
much.
Thank you very much, Anthony.
You take care, and we'll speak
soon. Yeah, thank you very much again, and thanks to all the listeners.
You're welcome. Okay, see you soon.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Andrew Johnson there from checktheevidence.com. What's that? 470. A few years ago, I seen something that looked like a cloud flying. Can you help me? Yes. Seen a few things myself that I kind of wonder what it is, you know, things hovering, staying still in the sky and stuff like that, but, you know, I'm not high enough, can't fly yet myself, so just have to walk by. Okay, so listen, that's the end of the show.